It's the Afternoon Magazine, and today on the program, Computers in You. Peter Kimball is our guest. He's the Education Program Coordinator and Lead Faculty Trainer for the FAST 3 Consortium, Center for Teaching Excellence at the University of Illinois. Listeners, I welcome your questions about computers for Peter. You can join us with a telephone call. The number to talk with us here on the Afternoon Magazine, 333-9455. That's the number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-WILL. Anywhere else, you can call us toll-free. The toll-free number, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Good to see you, Peter.
It's good to be back.
Okay, we have already got a listener ready to go, so let's take our first call this afternoon. Someone waiting for us on line one. Hi.
It is I.
Well, welcome.
Chicago calling.
Okay.
I'm on one computer with a laptop wirelessly, and I'm on the other computer, which says there are no wireless networks in range. I think I've tried everything, turning on all the processes that are available on the computer, and I can't get connected wirelessly to my network or to any other, nor can I get it to show any networks in range, and I know there are many. Any suggestions?
So you are, you said you're on a laptop, and the laptop is or is not connected. The two computers are.
Yeah, I have one laptop that is connected to my home network. I'm trying to get connected on another laptop to this or any other network.
Okay, so one laptop is able to connect wirelessly, and
correct,
the other one is not.
Yes.
And the one that is not is not even seeing any networks when you, I presume you're running Windows?
XP, yeah, Windows XP.
Windows XP.
Build 3.
Okay. And on the machine that is able to connect, when you look at the available wireless networks, you see a whole series of them, I presume.
Two, mine and someone else's.
Okay. And when you go to the other laptop, you don't see any.
Right.
The first thing that comes to mind is that most laptops do have, and often it's even it may not even be a setting. It may be a switch or a hidden button or a not obvious button on the keyboard itself to turn on and off the wireless capabilities.
Right. I have a Bluetooth switch.
Which would not be it.
A wireless switch, and the wireless switch is lit.
Okay, the wireless switch is lit. That's going to then, if that is lit, then we assume that, has this machine ever worked?
Yeah, yes, it did. Strangely, though, it would be on my home network. I could get onto my home network, but it wouldn't show it. You know, when I asked it to display networks in range, and then it stopped working altogether. I mean, as far as wirelessly is concerned.
Uh-huh. I'm guessing it's a little bit hard to diagnose remotely, but
sure.
One thing that would probably certainly verify this, it seems that it would not be a problem with your home network. Otherwise, the first machine would not be able to connect to it.
Right.
A problem that has occurred before, has this machine, the one that's not able to connect, has it been updated or had it had an older version of Windows on it or is a fairly new machine?
I'm using Service Pack 3.
Okay. Originally, which shouldn't itself be a problem, originally was this machine first purchased as a Windows XP machine or was it upgraded to XP or do you know?
No, I purchased it with XP installed.
Okay. It sounds like the most likely possibility. There's always a possibility of a hardware failure. There is inside, and it's actually not too difficult to get to if you're comfortable with taking off some of the panels on the back. There is an actual network card. If this has never quite worked properly, or if it's worked and then stopped working, There could be a hardware problem with the little network interface card that plugs into a slot, usually accessible by taking off a panel on the bottom of the computer, on the bottom of the laptop. The documentation from the manufacturer, Dell, if it's a Dell, or HP, if it's an HP, will identify where that is. It could be as simple as the those little network cards have an antenna wire or an antenna connection because the laptop itself, all of them that are, have this built in, have an antenna often around the edge of the screen or something. It's internal, so you don't see it. But that antenna wire has to plug into that card. So, and I've also seen one machine where that was a loose connection and just taking it off and putting it back on worked. Those are the two hardware possibilities. I don't suppose it's possible that this machine is still under warranty from the manufacturer.
No, never.
Okay. Well, that would have been nice. The other possibility, it's either got to be the hardware, which from what you say is certainly a possibility. It's also possible that the software driver could have either had problems initially or became corrupted by something else that was installed. Because just like the way that computers talk to printers or to keyboards or to screens, they also have to talk to their network cards, and that is done with what's called a software driver. So you could probably try going to the properties of your computer in the device manager, which you can get by right-clicking on My Computer and then saying you want to see the properties and device manager, and you can actually get that way, if you don't have it elsewhere, the manufacturer and the driver version for the network card. And then that you should be able to do a search for that company, or perhaps if it's a Dell or an HP, even if it's out of warranty, you should be able to find it at their website and try downloading and installing the network card, the network software again. You can do that also by going into the device manager and disconnecting. Say you want to disconnect that device, eliminate it. You're not doing this physically. You're doing it with the software through the device manager. Then when you restart the machine, it'll say, hey, I found a new device, or at least it should. And then you can try reinstalling your existing software driver. But those are the two, about the only two possibilities then, since we know that the network itself is working.
What about system restore? Would that, is that a possibility?
Well, I'd thought of that, but you could certainly try it, realizing that system restore will undo other things that you've done, although you can always undo the restore. But you had indicated that it was being a little bit flaky even at the very beginning, but that would certainly indicate, if you could get it back to the flaky instead of the non-behavior at all, that it was a problem with the software driver or with something that was conflicting with it.
You know, I've done that once before, but I've forgotten how to do it. Could you give me a quick...
Easiest way, because it's going to vary a little bit, just go on your main menu, just choose Help and type in System Restore, and it'll take you to the appropriate place.
Didn't come up with it.
Or try Restore Point. Let me see what it's going to actually say here for you. Let's see here. Hang on. I'll just try that. Good news for longtime listeners to this show. They have re-upgraded their computer here.
Finally.
Let's see. Set advanced restore options, restore points, restore system state data. So you should create a restore point, undo the last restoration. I got that under Help by just typing the search term restore.
Okay. I'll look for that.
Yes.
But thank you very much for the suggestion.
Okay. Well, good luck. And if it's not that, you may want to just break down and take it into one of the places that has computer technicians and see if they can, if you're not comfortable with trying to see if the card itself has a loose antenna connection.
Yeah. Now, is this, I'm trying to think back to what he had. Is this the problem with a laptop, is it?
It's with a laptop,
yeah,
yes.
So also, you could go out and about, take the laptop with you and see.
Yes, and see if it
go
works.
Go to your neighborhood coffee shop or whatever and see if it works. That would also be another.
Although we're guessing that it probably wouldn't solve it because the other laptop is showing the local wireless networks access points, and this one is not. So I would guess he'd probably find the same thing.
Okay. Yeah. All right. Shot in the dark, so to
speak.
Yes. Okay.
But good luck.
Okay. Peter Kimball is with us this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. This is the program we call Computers and You. We do it once a month on a Monday here on the Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions about computers for Peter Kimball. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. We also have a toll-free number, 800-222-9455. Let's take another call now. Listener on line two. Hi.
Hello.
Hello.
I was at a plant meeting the other day, and a friend was having a problem with his laptop. What sounds to me like spyware or malware, a weather program has appeared on the right side of his monitor, and it keeps giving weather reports. It also covers up part of the screen so he can't see what's going on over on the right side. I suggested using SpyBot or AdAware to try to locate it. Would that be an approach? Or,
well, is the friend running Microsoft Windows Vista, do you know? Or
no, it's running XP.
Okay. The reason I asked is that Vista has a gadgets panel over on the side that actually, among other things, has little widgets over there, such as weather.
I wonder if he actually is running XP or if it could be...
Because if it's Vista, that is there is a whole little sidebar. You can if it is Vista, you can right click on that object, and you'll have the opportunity in a pop up menu to close the widget or to close the sidebar, and that's certainly the behavior that is almost default with with Windows Vista when it's first installed, and all sorts of little things can appear over there. Which obviously take up screen space. But that would be my first thought, to check and make sure that he's not indeed running Vista.
Well, he's an older fellow who's not too computer savvy, and that may be. If it is XP indeed, then it sounds like malware?
Well, it could be malware. It could be... malware is some malware is in the eye of the beholder. It could conceivably have been something that is not maliciously working against him, but which he chose, perhaps not quite being aware of what he was doing, to install.
Mm-hmm.
There is another possibility, if indeed that is the case, and it was a legitimate but mistaken install, and it's Windows XP. Go to the control panel and add remove programs and look through the list and see if there's anything listed there that looks like weather related. Normally they'll have some, if it's legitimate software, a name that can pretty well be tied into what it's doing. So under start menu control panel, add or remove programs, if there's weather screen or weather window or something of that sort listed, it could be uninstalled.
I hadn't thought of that, but that's a good suggestion.
Also, if anything happens when that thing is on the screen, if he can right-click on it, I'm going to guess that it probably does not have a button down in the taskbar at the bottom of the screen.
Apparently not.
Okay, which is possible because some things are designed to be there sort of as a utility, whether legitimately or not. Don't take up the space on the taskbar by putting a button there.
Mm-hmm.
There may well be at the extreme right-hand side in what's called the system tray, the very right-hand side, there may be a small icon that is related to that weather little window that he has. And you can look at those, and oftentimes you don't see them all, but there's a little round button with a left-pointing arrow on it. And if you see down there anything that looks like it's weather-related, when you hover over it, you move the mouse over, and if it pops up and says weather or something, that may give you a another way of controlling it and saying, no, I don't want it.
Mm-hmm.
So those are what I would do.
Okay. When I talk to him again, I'll make those suggestions, and maybe I can talk him through something, and we can find it.
And if he's got a computer-savvy teenager in his neighborhood, they might be willing to come and take a quick look at it, too.
That's another question. He's up at Chicago. I'm down here, so it's a little bit cumbersome.
Right.
didn't sound as though there was such a person, but maybe there would be. So,
always
thanks possible. For the suggestions.
Okay, good luck.
You're welcome. Thanks for the call this afternoon. Other questions about computers are invited. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Our guest this afternoon, Peter Kimball. He's the Education Program Coordinator and Lead Faculty Trainer for the FAST 3 Consortium, Center for Teaching Excellence at the University of Illinois. No one waiting at the moment, listeners, so if you'd like to talk with us, give us a call. 333-WILL, toll-free, 800-222-WILL. Well, that caller mentioned malware. What about scareware?
Scareware, yes. And it actually is not a Halloween treat of any sort. But it's becoming more pervasive and a problem. And I was thinking of this as the caller was describing his friends having this appear. Scareware is essentially software that tries to scare the user into doing something that they will later regret. It's most commonly in the form of little pop-ups that say, warning, virus detected. Click here to download, you know, antivirus 2008. Or perhaps another message might be, your Windows registry is getting clogged and may cause your system to stop working. Click here to get the registry cleaner. Most all of those that pop up like that are not going to do what you think. They're going to download a program that may or may not have some antivirus components to it, but it is certainly going to be bloated with adware and other kinds of things you don't want. Most who are familiar with a lot of the various schemes and scams and phishing attempts will, once they've seen these once or twice, realize that they should just dismiss them, close them, even close the browser that was open at the time that they had that thing appear, just close that browser window. But they look official. They look like their official Microsoft or Windows message and warning boxes. The temptation is to click, you know, here's free antivirus software, mm-hmm. we'll fix your computer, and you just don't want to do it. There are even some, there are not as many, but there's been one reported that targets Macintosh systems that are going to particular websites. So that is what is generically called scareware, and it is becoming more and more of a problem as many of the other attempts to get software onto somebody's machine are being detected or being prevented by other software.
Okay.
But if you can get the user to click on something, then you can override a lot of that, and that's what the scareware tries to do.
Yeah. Let's take another call now. Listener on the toll-free line. Line 4, good afternoon. Where are you calling from?
Monticello.
Hi there.
Hi. Do you answer questions about Macintosh?
Well, we can certainly try.
Well, a while ago, the dashboard quit working, and now if I bump the mouse while I'm doing things, the screen fades. It's not as dark. It actually gets darker, like it's halfway asleep. And then I have to click the mouse again, and then it'll come back to life.
So the dashboard just disappeared entirely on you, or the dashboard is there and you can't launch things from it?
The dashboard is there, but when I click it, the screen goes halfway dark.
Okay. There could then be there are a number of possibilities. Is there anything in particular that you recall that happened or that you did prior to this problem manifesting itself?
Nope, it just showed up.
Okay.
By the way, when the screen goes dark, I get a plus sign in a circle in the lower left corner.
Well, it sounds a bit like there may be a corrupt dashboard file or files. So this is the first thing that I would try to do. It's not necessarily going to work. There are a couple of files that you can drag out to your desktop, and once they're out there, the next time you start up the Macintosh, it will say, wait a minute, I've got to replace these. You would find them in your user, whatever your logon name is, the library preferences folder.
Okay, let me jot that down, library
okay.
preferences.
Yes, yeah, it's the whatever your user is, so whatever your username is, like if it's Smith or Jones or me or whatever. Mm-hmm. In the library slash preferences folder, you'll find it in there.
Okay.
And the two files, this was from a a blog discussing problems with the Apple dashboard. The two files are called, they both start about the same time, the same way, com.apple.dashboard.client. It's an awful name. Dot plist.
And palm as in the palm of your hand?
Com, C-O-M.
Oh, okay.
Dot Apple.
Okay.
Dot dashboard.
Okay.
Dot client.
Okay.
Dot plist, as in just the letter P and the word list. And the other
dashboard,
one that's...
What file is dashboard?
I'm sorry, list. Just after client, a period, and then P-L-I-S-T.
Okay.
As in program list.
Okay.
And the other file is very similar to that. It is simply com.apple.dashboard.
Okay.
Dot plist. The same thing, but without the word client in there.
Mm-hmm.
That is one possibility. You'll probably find that those get replaced. The system will replace them automatically, and once you start it up, you could delete the ones on your desktop. That may not fix it. There are a number of other things you could do. What I would suggest doing after that, because it's, again, a little difficult to diagnose, is to go to use Google or whatever your search engine of choice is and type just the phrase, dashboard doesn't work.
Oh, okay.
Or screen goes dark, or dashboard doesn't work, screen goes dark. Try them both. Of course, if you get too specific, you may not get too many.
Yeah.
And then look for the things that are on places such as Apple Discussions. What I was just giving you was from Apple.com.
Okay. Now back a little bit. Is there these addresses? Is there a period after a dot after dashboard and after client?
Yes, there's a period in between all of them. So it's com. Period, Apple period, dashboard period, client period, plist.
Okay.
No period at the beginning and none at the very end.
Okay. I'll give it a try.
Okay. Good luck.
Thank you very much.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. It's 1:31. Today we're talking about computers. This is a program we do once a month, Computers in You, on the third Monday of the month. Peter Kimball, our guest this afternoon. And we're going to pause here for just a moment for a very important message. You know, public radio is funded differently than commercial radio. Here's how. Of course, if you've been listening for any period of time, you know. But here's how. Instead of selling a lot of commercials each hour to bring in revenue, we ask you, our listeners, to support the station directly with contributions. We use these contributions, along with business and foundation support, to give you hour after hour of news, information, intelligent conversation. We think it works quite well, so during our fundraising drive, we ask you to make a contribution to keep all this programming coming your way. You, our listeners, are the largest single source of revenue for WILL Radio. So give us a call right now, 217-244-9455, with a pledge of financial support. Focus 580 co-producer Martha Deal joins me in the studio now. Martha.
Celeste, can you imagine doing your show with 20 minutes of commercial breaks?
It'd be pretty tough, especially when you're trying to iron out complicated computer problems.
Exactly. So, for instance, just $10 a month helps pay for all the news and information you hear on AM 580. Call 217-244-9455 right now. You'll get right through to someone who can take your pledge online. Or if you're in a situation you can't pick up the phone, maybe you're at your computer. It'll take you almost as long, a minute. Go to willpledge.org and make your contribution online. No matter how you contribute, your call will help us do the essential work of keeping the news flowing each day. 217-244-9455. Call right now and make your pledge, and thank you.
Okay, and if you're listening on the computer this afternoon, if you're on the homepage, if you've got the homepage running, click on the light bulb in the right-hand corner of the screen, and you'll get to the spot where you can make a gift online. And so power up WILL, click on that light bulb. Again, the phone number, 244-9455 to make a pledge of financial support, and the website willpledge.org. Thanks, Martha. Okay, now back to the nitty-gritty with Peter Kimball. Let's take another call. A listener on line one. Hello. Line two, I'm sorry. Line two, my mistake.
Okay. I, by the way, have seen the scareware for Mac, and the only way you can get rid of it is to close the window.
Yes, that's often the case.
No matter what you tell it, yes or no, it, you know, it will not disappear. I mean, I guess if you said yes, it probably would, you know, go on. But if you say no, it just, it won't go away. So the reason I really called is I have an iMac, fairly new. I ignored the backup thing, and then my hard drive crashed and failed. Retrieved important stuff, but lost a lot of nitty-gritty, you know, address book, you know, stuff that I've had to redo. So what I want to know is what you recommend. I do not need, I don't have Leopard, so I don't have whatever that new backup program is that they have that my son told me about. And I probably won't get it, and I don't need a snapshot of my, you know, of my computer every day. But I want something that's going to be easy, preferably will do all changes, you know, at some regular interval. What am I looking for? And I'm perfectly happy to buy an external hard drive. I probably will do that.
Well, then what you're referring to is the Macintosh Wayback facility where you can actually create snapshots that came with a new version of the Mac
right.
OS from the old Sherman and Peabody Wayback machine back in the days of Rocky and Bullwinkle. But if you're and it is a good plan is indeed to purchase an external hard drive. And they're very inexpensive these days. And the good news is, although you may or may not particularly like the software, I find it a little bit cumbersome to use, but several of those, especially from Western Digital is one company that makes a line of external hard drives, and some of them are specifically oriented for Macintosh. And when you first power it up, it has backup software for the Macintosh that you can set to only to do a complete backup every so often, and to only backup changes on a more interim basis. So that's certainly one possibility. Now, the downside of that software is that after a trial of a certain amount of time, it'll say, well, if you want to keep using this, you know, you need to license it for $20 or $30 or so. What I would do, and because I don't need to what I've got with the Macs that we've got in our lab is I just, since they're lab machines, I don't have sensitive data on it, and I can just rebuild them entirely without any loss. But what I would do to get an idea of which ones would be good is do a Google search for a phrase such as Macintosh backup software reviews. You'll get a list of a whole bunch. I'm looking, for example, now one that's on CNET, which is pretty well regarded. And there's a list of a whole bunch of the Western Digital My Book World Edition is actually one of the ones that's listed up there, the external hard drive. So that would be my suggestion. I don't have, off the top of my head, a suggestion, unfortunately, for, you know, this, that, or the other software. There will be some software that comes with the external hard drive. You don't have to use it. Some of the backup software is going to be free or shareware. You don't have to pay for it unless you like it. Generally, not a hard and fast rule, but generally, if you get one of the well-rated commercial backup software packages, the ones that actually are going to charge you something between $20, $30, $40, they often are more convenient to use. Not always, but often.
Okay. And what do you think about storing information online? I mean, in cyberspace, however this is.
Well, there are a number of companies that do that. It is probably fairly safe. The only downsides, you would want to choose a company that's still going to be there in 2 or 3 or 5 years. There have been a couple of companies that have sort of not made it, and one hopes that in that case, whatever company takes them over is able to maintain the backup successfully. But for a lot of the larger companies, that's really not an issue. The other thing to be aware of is that if you need the information from the backup and for whatever reason you don't have access or can't get access to the internet, until you do, you can't get a hold of your backup files. So it's not quite the same as having them burned onto a CD or something that you've got at any time you need it.
On the other hand, it's not in my house.
The other hand, it is not in the house. What I would always recommend for whatever sort of backup, for things that are pretty well irreplaceable, a lot of digital photos and such of events that certainly can never be replaced, is to make to burn or create a CD or a DVD of those and then make a second copy of it and send one of the copies off to, a friend's house, a relative's house, something like that, so that you do have the irreplaceable data, that photos or whatever
right.
else, safe from any calamity that might not only destroy the computer but also backups that you have stored on site. So off-site backup is always a good plan. Whether or not you do it online or whether you do it just by creating a copy. Mm-hmm. One person who called in a couple of months ago on this show actually had purchased 3 of the external hard drives because they're only about $100 each, and he would just rotate them around and keep one at home and 2 elsewhere, and then he'd fill that one and switch them, and so he'd always have 2 versions of backups elsewhere. That's fine and maybe a little excessive, but... It certainly would do the job.
Yes, it would. Okay, well, thank you very much. I appreciate that.
You're very welcome.
Quite welcome.
Let's take another call now. Listener on line 1. Hello.
Yeah, good afternoon. First, I'd like to ask you, what's the Macintosh version of a right-click?
The Macintosh version of a right-click is to hold down the control key and click. So while you're holding the control key, down on the Macintosh, click.
Control key, and then click the mouse.
Yes, and that is the equivalent on a mouse that only has a single button, which is the standard
right.
Macintosh mouse. A lot of people, because it is a little bit inconvenient, are now getting, Apple's brand is the Mighty Mouse, which actually has 2 buttons.
Uh-huh.
Visiting
is
a lot
handy.
Of cartoon characters
yes,
here today.
Mighty Mouse, meet the Wayback Machine. But that is not available on a lot of machines, and so you simply hold control, and while holding it, click the mouse button. And anything that would happen with a right mouse click will happen when you do that.
Okay, that's different than the control button is different than that Apple button.
Yes, the Apple command button is a different button, and it's confusing if you're going back and forth between Windows and PCs because the Apple command button on the Macintosh serves the equivalent function of the control key on the PC. But to get a right click, you do not want the Apple command. You do not want the option alt. You want to hold down the actual key that's labeled control, CTRL.
Okay. All right. And then I have several hours of interviews on cassette tape that I want to burn CDs for. So what would you suggest how to go about that?
Well, your Macintosh almost certainly has an audio line in. It's got a place where you could plug in a microphone, although if it's got a built-in microphone, you won't see that. But it also, almost every Mac will have a line in, which means you could take the output of a cassette player, the kind of thing that you would normally plug into a stereo system if you had one, and with you might have to go to Radio Shack or something to get the appropriate cable that would at one end connect to the cassette player, and at the other end, this is assuming the cassette player is recent enough or is a high enough model, isn't the very bottom end model, so it does have a jack, an output jack that you could plug a cable into. You would have to check and make sure that the cable that goes, the connector at the cassette player end is the appropriate format for whatever your cassette player uses. And it's a fairly standard end that would go into the Macintosh. And then you can use almost any of the audio software that comes on the Macintosh to play music. It could be, you could even do this, I think, maybe with iTunes. But it is a case of playing that back while the software on the Macintosh is simply storing it on the hard drive, and once it's there, you can convert it to an MP3 version and put it out onto a CD or store it in a number of other formats. You will simply have to wait. There's no way of doing this quickly. It's not like a copying from one CD to another where you can do it at 2 or 3 times the speed. You're going to have to wait for that to play. If it's an hour tape, it's going to play an hour because it's coming out in analog form.
Okay, so I need to look for a cassette player that has an output jack?
Yes, an output jack, just something that would allow the cassette player to plug into some other speaker rather than using its internal speaker.
Mm.
A lot of people may have those if they've got a cassette player at all. Cassettes are sort of starting to disappear. But those who do have one, there's better than 50% chance that it probably has some kind of an output connector, a place where you can plug in a... But that's the first thing. You have to get it out of the cassette.
Well, is that the same as the jack for earphones?
Yes, it could be the same as the jack for earphones. You would need to be careful. Some of them have a separate jack that's coming out, or the signal comes out at a standard strength. With the earphone jack, you would simply need one other step. You would need to make sure that the volume control on the cassette as you're playing it on the cassette player is not set so high that might be appropriate for earphones but could cause distortion when it's just being plugged into the computer. But it certainly would work. It would certainly work. You might just have to be careful. There's just one other volume setting. But it's easy enough to do and test and see how it comes out with just a you know, 5-minute segment of tape.
Most of them have a volume control. You know, the one I use all the time when I'm biking is an earphone cassette. Not sure if it's a player or a recorder right this minute.
Well, it wouldn't matter as long as it can play. Recorders should be able to play as well.
But it has a volume control on the, you know, it's like a Walkman kind of thing.
Okay, so it's actually on the wire itself? Or is the volume control on the device?
It's on the device.
Well, then that would be fine. You just need to make sure that you don't have it set too loud. And again, I would suggest, as I have a couple of times, do a Google search for Macintosh analog audio or analog or cassette tape or record cassette tape. The 2 or 3 searches would bring up a number of forums and links to places where people discuss their experiences doing just the kind of thing you're wanting to do.
Okay. I hope that helps. And let's take another call. Now, a listener on line 3, good afternoon.
Hello.
Hi.
I'm calling with 2 questions. You can take your time to answer at your own limits. I am buying a new machine, Apple or Vista, and I'm wondering whether it is a bigger adjustment to go from XP to Vista or from XP to Apple. The second question is, I have a problem with my current XP. It is so slow, it's barely functional. Every click, I have to wait anywhere from 5 minutes to indefinitely before anything will happen. Occasionally, I can reboot, and it will briefly move at a slow speed, but at least it will function.
Okay, well, we don't have much time, but let me give you a couple of quick responses. In terms of your current XP, it sounds very much like you are thoroughly infected with adware, with bloatware, with perhaps various other software that is doing things behind the scenes. What you need to do is to be able to do a clean boot. You can hold down, I believe, as you're starting it up, press and hold either the F5 or the F8 key, it depends on which one, and go into safe mode, and then you'll want to run software such as Adware, Spybot, Search and Destroy, and get rid of what is most likely lots and lots of unwanted unwanted software on there. That is the classic behavior of a system that has had, you know, all of these various software programs come into it. And the problem is once the door is open for one, it invites all of its friends.
Mm. And also, could it be also that he needs to go into his recycling or his trash bin and dump
it
stuff
could be
out of there?
Because
sometimes that can get really full and...
If his disk is nearly full, that could do it, and defragmenting would help. But I'm guessing that there is also a problem with the bloatware, given if he really has a 5-minute delay sometimes between clicking. That indicates a lot of software running in the background.
Okay. And then the other questions about the learning curve, XP to Apple or XP to Vista?
It's... If you've got software that you're used to using an XP, it's going to be easier to do that, to become comfortable with using it in Vista. It's not going to be difficult to go to Apple. Vista and Apple both run fairly well. Vista runs quite well on new machines that have the horsepower to be able to run the software. Vista does not run so well on machines that are upgraded that don't quite have the underlying oomph to be able to handle it. For a given level of price and the power behind it, the Vista machine will cost you a bit less, but the Apple will be nice and shiny, but it'll cost you a bit more.
Okay, very good. Well, there we will leave it for this month's Computers and You. Our thanks this afternoon to Peter Kimball. He's the Education Program Coordinator and Lead Faculty Trainer for the FAST 3 Consortium Center for Teaching Excellence at the University of Illinois.